Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Media Answers Network, and is sponsored by the law offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Dr. Alexa Kimball, President and CEO of Harvard Medical Faculty Physicians at BIDMC in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Kimball.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Kimball, what I always like to do with all my guests before we really dive into the heart of our conversation is to give you a chance to provide a little bit more of a background in terms of who you are and what you do. So the floor is yours.
Terrific. So I am a dermatologist by training and really have spent much of my career doing clinical research, particularly in diseases like psoriasis and hidradenitis suppurativa. But along the way, I started to be very interested in the physician workforce, what motivates us, what choices we make, how we were going to end up potentially in shortage over the years. And that interest led to a role in administration, and now I am CEO of a 2,000-member provider organization that is Harvard-based and affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, as well as many of the hospitals in Beth Israel Lahey Health.
You're kind of, given what you said was your interest, that kind of transitioned you into the more management and administrative role, and the circumstances of what's happening in the world right now around COVID-19 and the pandemic and severe strain on the healthcare system. How do you see those two issues intersecting at the moment?
I think the training, interestingly, in clinical trials and public health that I did along the way, as well as workforce understanding, are incredibly elemental to all of the things going on right now. And I do think, it helps me to have perspective on both what's the epidemiology of the pandemic, how is it growing, how is it changing, and then really thinking about what are our physicians doing, how can they be supported, and are we putting them in the right places at the right time and protecting them to the best that we can? All of those things are fundamental. And again, I think the work that we did before really laid the foundation for it.
So in kind of picking up what you just said, what do you see, or what strategies are you seeing that are have been effective in helping to get physicians into the right place at the right time?
Well, it's an unpredictable situation. I would say, in contrast to New York, we in Boston have had a little bit more time to plan and prepare, and that's been really helpful. We're probably starting to see an increase in cases right now. I think we are waiting to see how big that actually turns out to be, but we use the time in between extremely well. So things that you think about when you're managing physicians are, we have, of course, people who are core to the response, right? The emergency department, the hospitalists, anesthesia, who comes in to do critical care providers as well. But there's a whole lot of other physicians that are intensely involved in patient care at the moment as well, that you need to think about, even if they're not in the news quite so much. Right, the OBs who are delivering babies, the pediatricians in the NICU and neonatologists who are taking care of people there, the trauma surgeons who are seeing patients, everybody, the psychiatrists who are very busy right now because of all the distress. So physicians everywhere are playing a role. And in sort of backup planning, you need to think about who has training or expertise that could be used to help spell or give a break to some of the providers in all of these different areas. So it's a planning exercise to figure out where those resources are.
Kind of the description you just gave really sounds like it also breaks down between both inpatient and outpatient. As you're saying, obviously you're going to be having an influx of patients into the hospital, but at the same time, it sounds like you're having to figure out effective means of still delivering services to patients outside of the walls of the hospital, or really probably outside the walls of any office.
For sure. And so when, essentially elective visits came to an end, based on both our observations of what were going on, as well as what the state was doing, I had a lot of ambulatory-based providers who didn't have nearly as much to do. Now, I would say a couple days before all those things happened, I sat down with my team and said, we have got to double down on telehealth. I recognize no one's paying for it right now, but this is all going to change, and we're going to have to take care of people remotely who can't get in to see us. So let's go. And literally within, by the following Monday, we had already introduced sort of the core pieces of a telehealth program. We're now doing about 1,000 visits a day that way. So that has been an incredible transformation that would have probably taken years in any other setting. And the good news is we were right, is that payers did start to pay for that and open it up. And we were really able to touch base with patients.
Your comment about that, you know, you said you might have been providing the telehealth without reimbursement up front, but that you'd expect change was very prescient, especially because we're pretty lucky here in Massachusetts that, you know, the governor actually mandated equal reimbursement across the board from MassHealth and commercial. But you know, I want to say that was probably about the same time as CMS was taking the similar action on the federal level.
Yeah, so we were a little bit ahead of them, but fortunately not a lot. And so that was great. And then the other, you know, CMS has done a good job of reducing some of the regulatory burden, and their announcement that there was loosening around HIPAA requirements for telemedicine also helped a lot. So those couple things coming together have shifted telemedicine to a completely new dimension. We're never going back. You know, we won't be delivering as much care, I would expect, as we are doing now, but patients will want it and doctors will want it. So, you know, this is really good from that standpoint. It's also interestingly, I think, revealed what the limitations of telemedicine are. And, you know, we are worried, particularly as time goes by and we're not able to bring some people into the office the way we would like, that may, you know, things are getting a little stretched thinner than we would like. And so I think we have a better understanding of what really needs to be in person and how we're going to manage that.
Yeah, and actually, that's a great point, because I'm kind of personally wondering, you know, as you said, there are limitations. And, you know, I've always shared that perspective that it's, you know, telemedicine is great for what it's capable for, but there are certain things, and it's probably a pretty broad spectrum of things that do require in-person, face-to-face care. So, you know, have you started developing strategies for still being able to have those types of services be delivered in person?
So I would say we're just starting to pivot towards that. We're still, you know, in the middle of our intense, you know, delivery at this point. But if you look out a little bit, you can see clearly what happens 3 months from now. Do payers start to go back to their old policies? How do we advocate to make sure that doesn't happen? Obviously, we'll need to go back to HIPAA-compliant platforms at some point in the game. When does that happen? It can't all happen at the same time across the U.S. because different parts of the country are in different phases of this as well. So I would say in rapid order, that's where my focus is starting to turn to, is what happens on the other side of this.
Yeah, no, I think that is, I think, a very good point, because it's, you know, as you said, so much of these changes or so many of these changes occur because it's the emergency. And, you know, that is a common question I see, is what happens when the emergency ends? It's, you know, theoretically, a switch will get flipped. And you're right, advocacy is going to be essential to get some of these things or some of these changes enacted permanently.
Yeah. I mean, my big takeaway was if we had thought that it was the regulatory environment and the lack of payment that was holding back telehealth, we just demonstrated that was true. So.
Yeah, no, they're a very good point. And but I wanted to turn to something where you're just saying, you know, it's, as you're saying, for the advocacy and change, you know, thinking about what will be required on that front as things, you know, kind of pivot back to whatever normal will be. I guess based on, you know, kind of the inside perspective of the front lines of care delivery, do you have any sense of where that change might occur in terms of getting back to a non-emergency state?
You mean in terms of telehealth advocacy or just general advocacy?
Or no, just, I mean, just in general, in terms of having the pandemic not as, you know, I think it will probably always be somewhere in the background, but not where you've got such a flood of patients both coming into the system as well as probably just walking around and daily life being asymptomatic and not knowing that they're probably positive.
Yeah. So, you know, I think all of us, again, we're in the middle of it at the moment, but you do start to think pretty quickly, how do we get out of this on the other side? And just like we had to shut down stuff abruptly, it makes it almost inconceivable to think that we will open things up nearly abruptly, right? There will have to be staggered gradual reopening of things, right? So that is, those are the types of things we have to start thinking about, is who are the patients we need to bring back in earliest? How do we prioritize them? How do we reach out to them? How do we sort through that in some way? How much pent-up demand is there that we haven't been able to address in between? You know, one positive thing is that telemedicine actually does potentially extend our capacity. So while our physical plant hasn't changed, our ability to have physicians interacting with people remotely, in addition to having fully capable medical facilities, does increase that. So that's another real reason why we have to fight to keep that open. So those are the types of things that, you know, I frankly look forward to thinking about, because it will be good when we're on the other side of this.
Yes, no, being able to, I think as you're suggesting, you know, kind of be focused on just the care delivery and maintaining high quality services without having to just kind of be scrambling, can feel like on a day-to-day basis, just to stay ahead of outside pressures that are, can feel very uncontrollable. I know we've been talking a lot about, you know, some of the remote capabilities, but I'd be very interested if you've had have any perspectives in terms of, you know, what might be happening within facilities and, you know, what are, you know, some of the real pressure points that are building within hospitals or other facilities where you might have physicians based.
Yeah, so I would say Boston, again, did a very good job pretty, you know, middle of the month of March of starting to, first of all, getting our university students back home and not coming back after spring break. That, I think, in retrospect, will be viewed with extreme importance, because it, first of all, decreased the population here. It decreased the population that was likely to be very socially engaged, and just took a bunch of stuff out of the mix. So that was helpful. The hospitals had already started to limit travel and other things to essentially prevent our physician workforce from either being exposed or from inadvertently getting quarantined and being pulled out of work for that. But then what we started to do, frankly, is empty out the hospital. So as we stopped elective type procedures, what we saw is a gradual switch over, not entirely, right? There are still people who need medical care for other reasons who are in the hospital, but over really a 2-week period, we transformed the patients that we're taking care of, or they transformed into a very different group. And, you know, it's interesting, we did that at pretty consistent levels, so that if you looked at how many hospital beds the patients in them, it was a pretty consistent amount. And in some ways, it's been a little less busy than you would normally find, because we were leaving the capacity open. And so that, again, was really helpful in leaving some bandwidth to be thoughtful about how do we create new teams that are trained a little bit differently, who would be able to be deployed. One important thing about our workforce in Boston is that we have so many physicians who sometimes spend some of their time doing other things. So we actually have a very deep workforce we can draw upon who are still clinically very engaged, but maybe weren't full time on that. So I think, you know, things, people who we find we could use more of today would be people like respiratory technicians who understand how to run ventilators and other things.
So for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Dr. Alexa Kimball, the president and CEO of HMFP, and we've been talking about the impact of COVID-19 on the healthcare industry. And Dr. Kimball, you were just talking about some of the advanced preparation that was occurring within the hospitals in terms of shifting patient utilization. You know, kind of what was, and also as you, the last thing you're mentioning was being able to tap a pretty deep workforce, and you know, it sounds like maybe start to get a little bit more time from some people as, you know, maybe research or other capacities that they would normally pursue were being cut off. So kind of what was being done to help ensure the protection of those physicians and other clinicians? And, you know, kind of from that, you know, kind of personal protective standpoint, you know, kind of what does the picture look like?
Yeah, I mean, PPE has been in the news quite a lot. And, you know, you need a lot of PPE to make any response to this pandemic effective. And there was definitely a supply chain shortage. There was also hoarding. There were also what consumers were doing. So there were a lot of factors that came into play. And obviously, the demand felt very sudden in terms of where the supply was. So I have to say, one of the most heart-lifting parts of this was our cry for help for people to bring us PPE. And again, this has happened all over the country, but we started calling around. We put out a call to our physicians in the community. We put out a call to our dentists in the community. We, you know, anybody who had masks that they could bring or gowns that they could bring, we asked for them and they came, literally boxes and boxes of them. One group that I approached said, we've been waiting for someone to call. Right? People just didn't know how to reach out. And there was a lot of so much activity. It was almost hard to manage. But the great news was is that we did find stuff. While the problem's not entirely solved, we've made huge progress in terms of getting more things available. So, you know, it's been good work.
Yeah, and kind of as you said, it's definitely been in the news a lot. And as you're saying, with kind of the constraints of the supply chain, and it seems like kind of everyone across the country competing, how has utilization of PPE changed? Because, you know, one of the things that you'll see is, you know, that masks might be used throughout the course of a day as opposed to, you know, changed after every interaction or, you know, kind of other modifications. So kind of what have you seen on the ground from that perspective?
Yeah, I mean, the guidelines have evolved as our understanding has evolved, as what's accessible has evolved. You know, it is our utmost priority to protect the workforce. And, you know, I think some of, as things have opened up and new knowledge has come, policies have definitely changed to address all of those things. And it's just been a balance between getting as much as we could in the door to be as liberal about that as possible, but making sure that one day you don't run out. And I think we're in a much better place in general for that.
Sure. And then actually kind of taking somewhat the flip side of it, you know, as you said, you might have had individuals out in the community who were taking up more of the supply than would be necessary. You know, and it seems like the federal government has pivoted recently to start recommending that individuals have a face mask when they're going out in public. So, you know, kind of for general purposes, is there any kind of settled sense in terms of what the benefit is for having a mask when you're just going out for hopefully what are limited runs for resources?
It's definitely still a, I would say, uncertain area, but here's some basic principles about it, right? We think that this virus is spread by respiratory droplets and then potentially touching surfaces that have it, potentially touching your face or and then getting exposures through that vehicle. So I think what people put out at the very beginning of this issue, it remains still true that when the general public is wearing a mask, they are probably protecting you more than they're protecting themselves. They're not necessarily preventing themselves from touching something and then infecting themselves, but if they cough or sneeze, they're probably protecting everybody else. So I think the concept of universal masking type behavior is actually about the entire population as opposed to individuals at that point in the game. But, you know, it does take careful management to understand how to use gloves and masks properly, right? So gloves are only protecting you if, in fact, they keep your hands, ungloved hands, from touching areas that are problematic. So you can touch a contaminated surface with your glove and then touch your face and you've just done exactly the same thing. So, you know, I think people have to be mindful that those are not necessarily fail-proof protection, depending on what they're doing. And that's why public health experts have really said hand washing is going to be key, no matter what you end up doing.
Right. It's kind of, I think what you're suggesting is, you know, protective equipment for individual use is only as good as how it's actually used. Hearing so many of the statements of how hard it is to not touch your face on an hourly basis, even as you said, even if you've got all the right stuff in place, if you're touching an outside surface and then go and touch your face with a glove on, yeah, it's not going to make a difference.
Right. I mean, the classic is you have a glove on, you touch a surface that's contaminated, you then touch your mask, and then in taking off your mask with your bare hands, you've now contaminated yourself. So it does take some thoughtfulness. Now, there's some stuff you might be reducing just because there is some benefit, but you can certainly use them wrong and negate most of the benefit.
You know, as we're starting to get close to the end of our time, I'd like to kind of pivot to, I think, one final area where there's definitely seems to be a lot of evolution, and that would be treatment. You know, it seems like it's hard to parse out what, I don't even know if you can say the best course of treatment is right now, but you know, can you provide any insights as to, you know, what happens for patients when they present with symptoms, and you know, maybe how treatment is impacted depending on the symptoms that are presenting?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges with this disease is when it is severe, it is not only severe, but it's very rapidly severe. So we find people don't have a whole lot of notice. And part of the what that presents is not only do you have to get them to the emergency department and whatever breathing support you need, but there's not a lot of time for medicines to help, right? And so that's going to be one of the challenges in creating medicines for this. And so it's just too far along by the time that you get there. And that's true with other less problematic viruses, right? So whether you're talking about influenza or even herpes, right? If you don't start medications for those within really 48 hours, you don't have any real benefit in terms of initiating them. And the earlier, the better. So that's going to be true with this as well. And given that we don't predict who gets really sick, it's more challenging. So I think the therapeutic big advances that we're going to need are either going to come through vaccines, testing to figure out who is already immune, so we know who already is protected, or some sort of prophylactic type medication, just like you might take for malaria or you know something like that. So it's just much harder to rescue people if they have gone down a really severe path really quickly.
And if you're talking about trying to start treatment within a 48-hour window, I think you said, is that 48-hour of the initial infection, which, you know, as you're saying, because it's hard to predict who's going to be severely sick from this, it seems like you might not even have symptoms within that first 48-hour window. So that makes it that much more challenging.
Exactly. So that's why obviously we need to do this work and it'll help to have things like that. But, you know, it's not super practical to say we're going to treat everybody before they feel symptoms. So you might figure out a post-exposure regimen, something like that might work. But that's why I think the prevention elements are just going to be so critical in helping us get through this and preventing us from having new episodes of it.
And from that prevention perspective, you know, I know you mentioned a vaccine would be one way of helping to treat. You know, what's really a realistic time frame for a development of a vaccine?
So hard to know. It probably won't be in time for this fall, which is what would be ideal. But I will say the vaccine development is much more accelerated than it used to be. And there are a number of candidates already in the pipeline, one of it which is based on the work of one of our researchers here at HMFP and BIDMC. So that is great news that we actually have candidates. Dan Baruch here, literally in January, as soon as the sequence of the virus was known, started to go, you know, to work on it immediately. So I'm optimistic that we'll get there. It probably, though, won't be in time for the fall.
Right. And it, I think on the whole, people understand that, you know, this type of work can take time. And yeah, as you said, you know, best case scenario would be to have it for that time. You know, I think as if progress is being made, you know, then you can have a little bit of comfort that there is kind of, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's lots of innovation and lots of good work. So I, you know, we're going to get there and we'll have good things that can help people. It's just like this virus has been a little unpredictable. It's a little unpredictable what and when and where. But the current, even just the current improvements we have in current testing and tracking and trying to prevent people from spreading clearly are making a difference. And we'll just continue to double down on that and then introduce these other things as they come along.
And, you know, kind of as we're pretty almost at the end of our time, you know, is there any sort of best advice that you'd like to make sure people absolutely remember during the time of this pandemic?
So I think what's out there commonly still remains true. The social distancing really matters. Reducing the spread really matters. Making sure that you pay attention to your symptoms and act on them quickly in terms of consulting with healthcare professionals, ideally remotely first if your symptoms are not severe. And then all these things we talked about, hand washing still remains kind of the top of the list. But everything that you do in those areas that keeps down you know, the load to the whole system is both a important thing for yourself, but also for the whole system that is trying to take care of everyone at the same time.
And Dr. Kimball, thank you for all those great pieces of advice. And as I said, believe it or not, we are already out of time. So thank you very much for joining today and being able to carve out time from what I'm sure is a very busy and hectic schedule at the moment.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.